Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young and Brian Brushwood. This is the number one Bigfoot dating show.
Oh, heck yeah. Justin, did you see when he gave the rose to the Loch Ness Monster? Did you expect that?
I thought that the skunk ape was so disgusting the way she acted getting so drunk the night of the honeymoon suite.
Oh, and the brown lady ghost, she was mad upset. She
you
said
know, that- the chupacabra really worked hard, really, really worked hard. You clean him up, you know, he stood a chance, but it's just there's all that kind of bias and whatnot. I think he sounds like the most interesting man in the world, to be honest with you.
I really just hope that the Jersey Devil's the next Bachelorette.
Oh my gosh, can't wait. Meanwhile, guys, it's time to play our favorite part of Weird Things, the super fun photo quiz.
Yay!
Oh, longtime listeners know that we love the super time photo quiz and that, oh my God, I know what this photo is and I know what this photo quiz. I think this showed up on my Facebook feed. Justin, do you know what we're looking at right now? Can you describe it for everybody at home?
Well, it certainly looks like a forest floor with a bunch of brown leaves, some newer green growth kind of sprouting up around it. But no, I have no idea what this is other than just a random picture of a forest floor.
So Justin, you're walking along. Maybe you got your big wooden staff that you got at the Renaissance Fair with the dragon's head on it and the lacquer, the sort of thing. Like you're maybe wearing some baggy pants and maybe a cloak, as you're known to do when you go through the forest.
Yeah,
enjoying thing a satchel full of books. You know, some really obscure medieval fantasy fiction, whatever. Maybe your fanfic too that you're writing about, like Dragonlance.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Sure. Yeah. All these things that I definitely have.
Okay. So you're walking along and you say, take a step, you put your hands on your hips and you're like, I love nature. I love this. And then a little elf pops out from behind a tree, maybe a forest ranger, could be an elf. And they say, hey, Justin.
Okay.
Take a look around you. You like nature?
Sure. Yeah. I love nature. Nature's the best.
You're not going to think that if you keep walking where you're about to walk.
Really? Wait, I mean, but I don't know. I mean, like, nature's about, I'm here on the walk for nature.
Really?
Yeah, I love it. I love every bit of it. You know, I think really the problem we have in this country is that we're not more in touch with nature.
So well, you're about to be really in touch with nature because, you know, often in the first segment of some podcasts I've heard, it's usually almost always about what?
Snakes?
What if I told you you're looking at a snake right now?
Right.
No, I'm not. Stop it. I'm not looking at it. That's a
okay,
forest
hold on,
floor.
Hold on. Real quick. Let me up the stakes on this. Justin, I am not kidding you right now. I'm going to up the snakes on this. Justin, right now, there is a snake in this photo, and I will give you $20. I will PayPal you $20 if you can find it in the next 5 minutes. I'm going to give you 5 minutes to stare at this. All right. Suddenly, Justin is later. Not interested in being on the podcast, and he's only
no. I'm looking at it. No, I gotta look here. I gotta get a good gander at this.
We've learned from previous episodes, you're never safe. You're not safe on the internet, as we found from the people in the. Was it the Indonesian internet cafe where the guy literally just opens the door to leave the cafe? It's why the real world sucks, folks. He got away from his computer. He was going to go, like, guys, enough of this computer stuff. I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to get some fresh air and some nature. He opens up the door. He doesn't even step outside. What happened? Damn
snake, came right up in him
through the door. It's like, that'll teach you. It's why we never leave. It's why I just drink Soylent and use Amazon Prime to survive.
Amazon Instant Now and drone delivery will be your salvation.
Okay, Brian, I don't know what. I'm as much as I would love to take your $20, man, I'm going to have to tap out on this. I was never really good at these photo hunts to begin with, but now I'm terrified. I thought I was on. I thought me and Nager were cool. Next thing you know, they're hiding snakes right in front of me.
Okay,
all right,
so Justin, what, here's at the what top.
You need to do. Take your all finger. Right,
well, hold on, real quick. I can I give you a hint, Justin?
Wait, sure. Let's, we give a hint, use a finger hint. Tell them where to put the finger.
Look at my screen. Where my finger is, you'll notice my finger is dead center in the center of my screen. That is where the snake is.
Put your finger on the screen right now, the center of the button.
I am now telling you where this snake is. Can you see it, knowing that I'm telling you that there's a snake there?
It's really dead center.
Dead center.
Look for bands.
Oh, you want to know what? I can't see this. I can't see this snake.
All right,
no.
Get ready. Get ready for the magic. Get ready for the magic, dude. Enhance. Okay, so now, hold on.
We zoomed in a little bit. Can you see it? All
right, get ready. It's in the center right now. Right now, it's in the exact center. Now it's slightly above center.
Hmm. It's just like some sort of tiny snake.
It looks like a reverse question mark.
All right, we're going to get another zoom.
All right, boop. Enhance, boop. enhance.
Oh, my God.
Do you see it?
Oh, Jesus Christ. That is... That looks like it, like a poor Photoshop. Like, that looks amazing.
Right? It looks like somebody just Photoshopped the letter S and clicked emboss, and then that there it is.
Oh, it's my
so amazing.
God.
It's further back. You only see part of it, and you zoom in closer, you see more of the snake, and then more, and you're like, oh, my God, there's a snake there.
So is this like one of these viral things that's happening where it's like, hey, point out the snake? Share it once you get it. Tag 5 friends who love snakes.
I'll tell you what. There's every random moment that you're like, oh, no, I get it. That's why nature works.
Yeah, works really well. So, gentlemen, got some other cool photos. I want to show you a real quick one. You heard about the tree stump on Mars?
I'm sorry. It sounded as though you asked about a tree stump on Mars.
Trees. I didn't know that Mars had trees. I mean,
apparently they do, guys. There is a tree stump on Mars. Well, there's a photo of what looks like a petrified tree stump. And I'm going to challenge. I gave Bryce no warning on this one, so we'll see if he's able to find it. But, hey, you know, like, there's a lot of cool photos from Mars because it turns out that Mars has as much land as Earth does. And because, you know, without the oceans taking up, you know, space,
sure,
as much
sure.
land, which means there's going to be a lot of weird things you're going to find, including we've seen this before. We've seen like from little small features, these little weird berries type things. We've seen the sloping lineae, which is what may be water flowing in a very briny solution. A lot of just amazing and fascinating features, weird looking rocks. And now we have this.
Oh, my God. Okay. And this is the quote from wherever British tabloid Bryce has found this on. Alien hunters claim to have found evidence that the red planet may have once been lush with green vegetation, as there is the petrified remains of a Martian tree.
Okay.
And I'll tell you what, from that vantage point, gosh darn it, if it doesn't look like a petrified like a little tree had been snapped in half.
It's a little bit jaggy for my tastes to believe it's a tree, like not enough rounding. Like, it does look like to me, it looks a little bit more like a calcified crystal growth, like I don't know, like something crystallized on the Martian surface.
Well, you don't think that the side of the tree is sufficiently barky?
I think it's too barky.
Look at the rock behind there, and you get this sort of the slatted sort of rocks with deposition layers, which implies erosion or implies some forms of that. So, you know, it could be anything, but, you know, that we thought, you know, looks like a tree stump. It certainly does look like part of a tree stump. No disputing that at all. And we're going to find lots of things on Mars that are going to look like other things, but are going to probably have regular, normal geological explanations. It would be weird if they didn't. But
with the trees in the back or the rocks in the background, it almost looks like the scale of this would be huge, right? Like, if you there's a bit of a dune almost in the bottom left corner here that makes me think this is way bigger than we.
You know what's funny is, like, when I first looked at it, I would have described it as 3 to 4 feet tall, but looking at that dune and thinking about it in the scale that you described it, Bryce. Like, then it suddenly looks like it's a 50 or 100-foot tall monolith.
Right.
Pretty sure it's only 3 or 4 feet tall because from the vantage point this was taken, if it was taken from one of our little rovers, then
right. But Bryce does make a good point, because this is why those mysterious gravity spots work on the side of hills. Is like oftentimes what happens is the land shifts due to a partial mudslide or whatever, and then your brain, when it sees trees in the background, it assumes they're vertical up and down. But after a minor landslide, the trees are very oftentimes like at a, you know, 30 or 45 degree angle, which skews your perspective of where, you know, down is. And that's why they're able to do demonstrations of like water rolling uphill and all that stuff. And so I would say this was the same thing, like seeing when I didn't notice the dune that Bryce was talking about, it looked 3 foot tall. But then when Bryce said, no, look at the dune, I perceived it as a, you know, large, you know, 20 foot tall sand drift or whatever. And then all of a sudden it skewed everything.
The person, I guess, who originally posted this photo on YouTube did describe it as about being 3 feet in height. So it's just kind of a weird, like, sense
like,
of scale.
Like an artifact, right?
Yeah.
The biggest problem is, if, of course, like if this was like 100 feet tall, then it would need to be, as Andrew intuited, mm-hmm. shot from an aircraft that was in order to not see the horizon.
And it would be much, we would have probably seen it already. Like it would be much more widely known than this past month. We have another photo.
Still, it's cool. It's one of these things that's, you know, very cool about the idea of, you know, exploration is that, even just right now, with just one little robot, a couple little robot-sized probes, we're seeing fascinating things. And I think it's why I personally love the idea of getting people on the ground. What else are we going to find? And it can just all be geological phenomena, and it could be fascinating if you're a geologist. Fascinating.
I guess that's the greatest thing about where we're at right now in terms of exploration, which is also awesome that like we kind of, over the last 10 years, sort of have these like grayed out future things of like, all right, exploration. What do we explore these days, right? You know, we explore the bottom of the sea. We've explored, you know, this little corridor of space a little bit. But now this like, oh, wow, now we have more time. We have more access. And like things like Mars, like humans on Mars is a, you know, either anywhere between distinct possibility or pending reality, depending on where you want to put it. But like now just the idea of like, oh, wow, I guess there's just like a lot of assumptions that we've had that, you know, we've done our best to inform them. But like now we're just going to get to see for ourselves. This is just so exciting.
Well, we're going to tell you some rumors and innuendos about timelines for Mars right after we tell you about what we're doing with our Patreon.
Heck yeah, dude.
Yes.
Go ahead, Justin.
Patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can support this very, very show. Head on over there right now. Patreon.com/weirdthings. But not only are you going to get special RSS feeds for our After Things show, you will also get so much more. Isn't that right, Bryce?
That's right. We've been talking about finding new ways to add goals to some of the Patreons. And one of them that we're looking at doing for Weird Things is a feed of just Journey Quest. So it would be the Journey Quest episodes that have been already done, cut out, and on their own, you know, as their own episodes. And then any future Journey Quests would go in that feed, only accessible to patrons. And I think the number we were looking at last time we talked was about $5.50 an episode. So it's pretty reachable. And at that level, we'll also do more detailed show notes, which includes time codes and more links to articles that we talked about in the show. So if you're not already, please go to patreon.com/weirdthings and pitch in. $1 an episode means a lot.
Dude, what is this? $81. $81 in pledges is all we need to make Project Journey Quest happen, where you can listen to the longest, most meandering audiobook you've ever heard.
Meandering?
I mean, I'm sorry. You may say meandering. What I mean is there's lots of twists and turns.
You said meandering.
Yeah, no. Brian says, you may say meandering, and by you, I mean me. But what I really mean...
What I mean is there's lots of twists and turns and surprises, and I think you'll have a great time, especially if you love Quiznos.
Brian, it's not like I make this up 2 minutes before the show starts.
Good point.
I make it up as soon as we announce it's time to do Journey. Yeah. That's giving me way too much credit.
We are super, super pumped about this. And I'm, to be honest, I'm really excited about the Journey Quest thing because, like, I would love to listen to it all back to back to back to back to back. Like, that is an experience that literally nobody, including us, have ever had, listening to this as one solid story.
And we've had people ask about it in the Reddit and in other places of, like, hey, what if – can I just get – I just want – like, it's kind of hard, and it's in all these episodes, and it's not in every episode. So this way we'll make it a lot easier to get.
I got to be honest. Like, I feel like I'm terrified at the idea of listening to it straight through because very rarely have I read an audiobook where, like, a third of the way in, the narrator forgets what the story is and very obviously doesn't remember what he just said before then.
Sure.
I think I've remembered mostly what's gone on for the most
part. No. I'm talking about us, like the main character actors.
I'm not violently arguing with you and saying that I haven't forgotten. I'm just saying maybe I have not. But gentlemen, that's great. That's all nice. But you know what happened today that's now become, we're at the moment of a ho-hum?
What?
SpaceX had a launch this morning.
Oh, yeah. It put off from the weekend, right?
Yeah, they did an NRO landing. And oh, my God, we're watching it land back on the pad. And you know what? There are actually SpaceX conspiracy theorists that, like, don't actually think they launch or land stuff.
Oh, hold on. I have thoughts, but I want to hear more about these guys.
I had a friend who is very prone to these sorts of things who's like, well, you know, there's some people who think this experience, like some flat earthers, other people think it's a conspiracy. I'm like, what? Like, well, you know, if you watch some of the feeds, it looks like it's there, you know, when they're blue screen stuff. I'm like, when the people in front, I'm like, where have they done that? Oh, like when they're in the, like, they're supposed to be in front of the control room cheering. I'm like, they're in front of the control room cheering. Well, it looks fake. Like, what does that mean? And so anyhow, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but it's one of these things. Like, how are you, you know, like, you're just saying, you know, it's like, I've seen plenty of shops in my day. It looks, you know, it's like, all right, you know, we can have an entire discussion about criteria and evidence and whatnot, but that seems like a really extreme point of view. They landed today. SpaceX landed on. This was a very high profile, well, high value mission for National Reconnaissance Office, the NRO, which is like the super, super, super spooky space agency that is like, or a spy agency that's like, you know, got like probably one of the biggest budgets of all because so much of it's like off the books kind of thing. And they actually, NRO is interesting too because they're like in a lot of like government bids and stuff. NRO can actually just sort of say, we're going to hire whoever we want in the interest of national security, which has been interesting. But now they've decided they're going to use SpaceX. I've attempted to use them for this, which is great. Booster landed, et cetera. But meanwhile, what was really cool is this weekend, on Friday, Elon Musk did a TED interview. Spoke at TED with Chris Anderson, and it was about a 40-minute interview. And he talked about one of the big things was he unveiled his Boring Company. That's the company that wants to build tunnels underneath our very feet.
Yeah.
And there's a video. Have you seen this video demonstration of what they're doing?
No, I've not.
Watch this. So this is the demonstration of how this would work. So we're watching a beautiful Tesla pull up to what's called a skate. Basically, it's just the size of a parking spot on the side of the road in a busy street. And it's now lowered on an elevator into a massive underground system of tunnels. And it's driven along by this electric skate. So the car's on a platform that's actually moving it through the tunnel system. It can go up to like 140 miles an hour is what he describes it. He uses an example of like in Los Angeles, you know, you could get from the middle of town to the airport in 5 minutes. And
mock-ups for people movers too. In this video.
He shows like they have what here is just a bunch of people in like kind of a public transport with clear plastic that, you know, getting into that. And the point that he makes, and I think this is true. I've had a discussion with somebody about the tunnel thing before, and they're like, and it was all my talking points I watched Musk repeat, which this person says, well, you're just going to, if you move roads underground, you're still going to have congestion. And I'm like, it's 3D. You can only build one layer of roads on the surface. You can have a couple, you know, overpasses and stuff, but you can't do that. Tunnels, you just keep doing more and more tunnels. You know, we dig deeper than we build buildings, which is a point that Musk pointed out. And so if you have the tunnel technology, and that's the critical problem. And you know, I've heard this, the rebuttal is like, well, it's expensive. It's like, yeah, if only we had the guy that figured out how to reduce the cost of space travel by a factor of 10 work on tunnels.
A gamer chick in the chat says, why not just transport people and get rid of cars altogether? Because it's not that simple. It's the reason why a lot of like light rail stuff is very successful in some cities that are, you know, walking and commuter friendly, and not in others that are very car friendly. Very often you want to get from point A to point B, the congested point, very quickly, but you'd like to drive specifically where you want to go past that.
Right. Well, yeah, there's specifically like the factor of optioning, like, for example, you know, we just went to Canada and it was important to us, even though we didn't know what we would need of all the stuff that we packed and threw into trunks. We knew that the hotel would be one place and that the venue where I would perform would be at another place. And so it was worth the extra $50-$100 to rent a car rather than just to a taxi, because I knew that I wanted the option of being able to drive over to the venue and know that the entire show was in the back seat of this this vehicle and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I keep a bunch of stuff in my car, like books and things like that. If I go somewhere, I might need to give to people. And there are times when I don't need that, and there are times when you do that. It will – the self-driving future is going to do two things. It probably – it'll put more vehicles on the road, but they'll be electric, you know. But one of the things it will do, though, is that it will increase your ability, make it a lot easier for a lot of the things. We're like, yeah, I don't – I mean, if I want to carry a bunch of groceries or something like that, then, yeah, I want my own car. I don't want to have to share a vehicle with a bunch of five other people to be like, yeah, meet me at the supermarket and wait 5 minutes in the parking lot for me to load.
Yeah.
It's silly. But, you know, you think about this, though, is that like, and we go, well, in the future, they'll send you all the groceries you need. We're still going to want to browse. We're going to still want to do that. It's yes and. There's always going to be options. So we've talked about this in the show where through a lot of discussion, like, yeah, we see a future like maybe your family has one car, your one sort of car that you kind of keep. Not everybody will need that, but you can have the one sort of family car, which might be the big old minivan kind of thing. And think about this. Now, one, I think this thing that amazes me about the tunnel stuff, and it's worth watching, is Musk gets into what they're trying to do because they want to make it 10 times cheaper, right? They want to reduce the cost factor by 10, and he explains how they think they can do that from making smaller tunnel size, making this tunnel smaller, changing the way the process in which you bore a machine. Half the time the boring machine isn't there because you're reinforcing. He talks about if you can reinforce as you go along. He talks about how if you improve the thermal efficiency of the tunnel, of the boring machine, you can get a speed increase. So he lists off all these things that you can do. If you do this, do you do this, do this, like he did with space travel, how you could increase the speed. And he gives some great examples there. He talks about how, you know, how fast are tunnels right now. And he says, you know, my kids have a pet snail named Gary from SpongeBob. And, you know, Gary, Gary is a very slow snail because the tunneling machines are 14 times slower than Gary. And his goal is if we can beat Gary, we can do that. He talks about how in Los Angeles, there was a, we had a tunnel extension that was about 2.5 miles that cost $2 billion. It was $1 billion a mile, which is ridiculously expensive. If you want to build a massive tunnel network, you can't do it at that scale. Now, of course, there was a comment in the comment room says, well, he's catering to like the coast. It's like, no, he lives in LA. This is where he focuses. But any place with sufficient density would want to be able to utilize this.
So, In the case of SpaceX, there's a very tangible difference of how he wanted to do things, like launch the first stage, land the first stage, reuse the first stage. Like, I get that. That's fundamentally transformative. Mm-hmm. Is there a similar technology, a similar pivot that makes the Boring Company as inspiring as SpaceX?
A more efficient boring machine.
But no single easy to tell grandma idea. Mm-hmm.
If you say this thing goes 10 times faster, builds a tunnel 10 times faster and cheaper, you know, because I think it's kind of quasi between where SpaceX was and Tesla was, where Tesla's like, if we can solve this problem, and Tesla, a big part of the thing was the battery tech, we can solve the battery tech type system, and then the next gen problem for them is, you know, the vision system, then we have this thing.
Right.
So, yeah, Justin, so it's more the, like, we just need to build a better battery, you know, and they need to build a better boring machine, right? And I suspect part of what I think you can see with a lot of Elon Musk's inefficiencies that he likes to attack to make these companies is the idea of like, all right, well, let's put, now that there are these weird people like Elon Musk that are super rich and super smart, and the money in like super rich is this astronomical kind of level, Now you can say, all right, well, who's buying companies, you know, these machines that make tunnels? Like, they're usually governments, if not massive private construction companies that are just, they got money to burn. But let's innovate in these spaces where not a lot of innovation necessarily needs to happen, because the people that own the machines don't rent them out all that often, and the people that they rent them to generally don't care about the price all that much.
Yeah, that's a critical thing, and it's very much like the rocket industry is that you'd say, okay, one of the problems you get into why things are expensive, it's because the market will pay that. And when the market is the government, and if you have all of your major companies that do this say, yes, this is how much it costs, which is what happened with rockets, between Boeing and Lockheed and everybody else, like, yeah, no, this is the area, this is the window. You maybe get 10% or 15% save your cost, that's it. The same with massive tunnel projects is, and once you start a tunnel project, you can't really fire the people that you started with. You can put all sorts of little things about how much, you know, the big dig, you look at all these things, and it's just a recipe for just out of control expensive. And the slower it is, you as a company are incentivized for that. You want it to be slower because you're making money by, you know, getting paid for all of the overhead, for all this going, you know, getting paid for every person working on it and the amount of time. Why do oil cleanups take up so long to fix, by the way? We pay oil cleanup companies by the hour, right? So there's not that, you know, XPRIZE came up with some better technology to solve that problem. Like, here we go. People are like, yeah, the problem is they get paid by the hour to do this. And so no oil cleanup company is really incentivized to clean it up faster. Same with construction projects. If you're a construction company and you know that there's a better chance you can get this project to last 5 years instead of two or three, not that I'm accusing them of doing anything nefarious or whatever, you're just going to work towards what is your maximum efficiency. You know, your maximum efficiency is making the most profit. How do you make your most profit in that situation? By spending the most hours on the project and using the most amount of equipment.
Right. So, like it's
and especially in big projects where safety is the key, right? No one's, you know, the idea that you're going faster for efficiency, but oh, God forbid, if there's something wrong and there's an oversight, then now, like, they finished, sure, under budget and ahead of schedule, but now my child's dead.
He brought up a point where people say, well, if there's tunnels underneath, you know, it's going to be noisy. And in typical Musk fashion, he said, well, you know, if you have a means to tell when a tunnel or people are moving, operating through a tunnel that's more than three times the diameter of the tunnel width below you, then Israel would love to know about this. And so would the border immigration because of tunneling. And they don't have that technology. So if you have that, you'll make a lot of money. And so it's great. You could tell he's had so many cocktail party conversations with the people like, what about this? And then, you know, he brought the flying car thing. Like, you know, there's a lot of people think the future is a flying car. And Elon Musk's point was, it's noise. And that's the big thing. I've had people like, oh, self-driving cars. No, it's be flying cars. I'm like, have you heard a drone? Have you heard a drone? What is it going to sound like when there are thousands of the car-sized ones in the air? It's huge. It's not to say that at some point we might solve that problem, but that's a tech problem we don't know the solution to right now. And Musk says, and what about, are you worried if they're flying overhead? He calls it would not be anxiety reducing having thousands of flying vehicles overhead. Like, what if, did they service their vehicle or am I about to get decapitated by a hubcap? which is why I think that, you know, what we talked about, what Uber would talk about with these flight corridors makes a lot of sense. Absolutely makes sense. You're going to be okay falling that way.
Yeah. By the way, of all of this news, this is kind of a weird sideways angle to take it, but on Cord Killers, in the beginning, Tom and I were, you know, breathlessly talking about original content for Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime, and then we breathlessly talked about the fact that they were winning Emmy awards and so on. But now we're at the point where it's like the news hits and we barely even register. How great is it that the news this week was, NRO satellite gets launched, also sticks the landing. I guess, you know, that's a middling, what is this, the fifth, sixth, seventh time?
Yeah, and it's now it's this, oh, yeah, it's cool. Yeah, it's good. Hey, all right, you know, good guys, right? You know. It's like, oh, the footage is great, but it's become, you know, routine, which is what you want, which is what you want it to be sort of, you know, it happens normally in a way it's supposed to be so many times that you just accept that. But now the conversation shifts to, like, is it smart or is it bad, you know, start – you know, we know the we can see the trajectory literally and figuratively of where rockets are going between Musk and Bezos. You know, I don't want to discount Bezos and what he's doing, his billion plus a year he's putting into reusability. And I think in the next 2 years, that's going to really become a big deal as we talk about that. And I'm going to segue into there was a our president met with some NASA astronauts and they talked about like getting to Mars. And he mentioned something about like because the current NASA plan is sometime in the 2030s to do some sort of Mars mission. But it's not a really laid out plan. Part of it is based on like the SLS rocket technology, which we're not the biggest fans of because it's not reusable. It's prohibitively expensive, costs over $1 billion to launch. And people like, well, we just need to fund our NASA program, our Mars program. It's like, and I think our mindset like, yeah, let's fund one based upon either Blue Origin or SpaceX coming up with reusable rockets, because then it'll be a heck of a lot cheaper. But anyhow, he says, yeah, let's get to Mars. And they're in, and they said, you know, he said, I mentioned something about like, do we have a plan for getting there? And they said something like, well, long term's like, I would like to see it in my administration, maybe even the first one, the first.
The first administration, the first 4 years,
the first 4 years, but
the one that is 101 or 102 days old. Yeah. Like that. And you know, yeah, that's. We can kind of daintily skip over, you know, the speaker. But in general, the anybody in a position of power in the federal government saying that this is something. Yeah, the quote is, try to do it in my first term, but at worst during my second term. So we'll have to speed up that NASA timeline a bit. Okay, question mark. It certainly is regardless of your political affiliation, reflective of the reality on the ground right now. As braggadocious as that sounds, the idea of a faster trip to Mars is something that is feasible, you know, in a way that it hasn't been in forever.
Yeah, we have Blue Origin and SpaceX are furiously working towards developing the technology to facilitate that and reduce the cost of that. Musk brought up, they said that in maybe 6 weeks, he'll release more, you know, stuff about the ITS, their next generation rocket system they want to build, which would be capable of that. And I've heard all sorts of rumors and stuff and had some things that were maybe confirmed to me by people who are not realizing they were confirming stuff, but he says our internal deadline is much more aggressive, because they're talking about like an 8 year trying to get this done in 8 years. Says internally they're much more aggressive, which means he's trying to figure out how to do this much faster. And one of the ways they might try to do that is that if they want to build the big one of the things he says too, which gets forgotten, is he chose that big huge rocket that's just like five times powerful as, let's say, the Saturn V. Is he goes, and this will look like minuscule compared to the ones we'll eventually be using, which is sort of interesting that he's talking about building even more massive rockets than that, you know. But with SpaceX and the ITS next gen rocket, biggest problem they have is, you know, he wants to build without going bankrupt, is that part of building that would mean building entirely new infrastructures and factories to be able to do that if they're going to use the existing system. So some speculation is that they may be taking the existing SpaceX factories that we have right now and in a couple years' time use those to produce the engines and most of the components for that and just switch over entirely to building the ITS.
Wow.
Or a different scale one, maybe a smaller ITS, because you tried to do one with the big core. It wouldn't really work to ship that from LA to Florida, but if it were slightly smaller.
That's like, it's insane that we're already seeing this company kind of turn a generation in its rocket technology. Like that's insane.
I spent a lot of time around young physicists and engineering students, you know, who are in their, you know, early 20s, late teens. And Elon Musk, they were too young for Steve Jobs, too young to be, you know, Steve Jobs is some guy they heard talked about when they were a kid. He is their Steve Jobs. He is their Tony Stark, Steve Jobs. He is a guy they look up to and, you know, absolutely, you know, idolize the fact that this guy's making things and getting things done. And that's cool to live in an era where we have people doing cool stuff that you can say, man, if this guy's doing this, then maybe the thing I'm doing ain't that hard. Maybe my new toilet paper roll I'm designing isn't the biggest problem.
Maybe this is possible too.
Yeah. So I got one more item before we hop into some other segment. And this is kind of interesting. There was an article that came out that I immediately emailed Matt Ridley. I go, I'm very, very skeptical, but it's still kind of cool and interesting. And what it was, scientists said that they may have found evidence of a human civilization 100,000 years ago, stone tools, dun dun dun, in North America.
Whoa.
So incredible discovery places humans in California 130,000 years ago. Now, for context, the oldest evidence that we have that we believe is pretty solid is 15,000 years ago. Here are the problems with this, okay? And I'm not saying it's not true or whatever. There are a couple problems with it. One is our evidence for humans even leaving Africa that early is scant because of there was the Great Barrier. There was a lot of issues where we think humans were bottlenecked up there for much longer than that, and it would have been an early exodus. But I'll give you a possibility in a moment here, okay? So that's problem number one, is we have like this almost no evidence of humans even leaving Africa, you know, around that point. Two is the evidence on they say they found with mastodon bones and stuff like that, like tools and things like that. Finding tools mixed in with a bunch of really, really, really old bones is not, it's hard to date. It's a very, very, very difficult way to date stuff. And, you know, there could be a lot of possibilities that could explain this that might make more sense because, you know, we're asked to be able to make a number of assumptions to say here. But they found the tools. They say this is the period that's dated. So it's a very valid question of inquiry. And I'll give you one more little aside, and then we can throw it to the discussion here about the viability of this is we get 100,000 years ago, we had an interglacial period right now. Now, as we know, we're what's called an interglacial period, which means we're not really out of the ice age. We're in this period of a warm period, which started about 10,000 years ago. 100,000 years ago, we were in what was called the Eemian period, which was also an interglacial period where the glaciers retreated and it was very warm, maybe warmer than it is today. And we have evidence of some other kind of hominid expansions. We don't have evidence that humans made it out of Africa at that point. But it's possible they did make it out of Africa, small groups, whatever, and they expanded. And then when the Ice Age came back, it could have wiped them off completely while the Neanderthals were like, hey, man, we're cold adapted. You know, sucks for you. So there is a possibility because there was 100,000 years ago a warm period. And I always thought that's an interesting area for fiction because you could have had a Roman era civilization built in Northern Europe. And then the glaciers would have gone through and sort of reduced you to nothing. And we would be hard pressed to find any evidence of that now. So.
Hold on. Lot to unpack.
Throw it to the table here now.
Yeah.
Lot to parse.
Okay. So first of all, the idea that humans. Okay. So the story as I know it is that humans, Neanderthals, both around the same time in the Middle East and then moving into Eastern Europe and then
Neanderthals were there a couple hundred thousand years way before us.
Okay.
In Europe.
But how was it that humans were originally the default? What is the default hypothesis here that we went across the Bering Strait and then or the Aleutian Islands, is that what it is, on Alaska and then made it down through Canada to modern day North America?
You had during the Ice Age, the water level was much lower, right? And it meant coastline was radically different than what you have. So it was entirely possible to walk all the way from Europe into what's Russia now and into the Americas because there was land. Where we see a bunch of little islands, there was available land there that you could walk across and do that. As the glaciers melted, the water levels rose up, and so you had, you know, it was much more difficult to do that. So we've got this map showing the expansion of humans. And we see humans leaving Africa and going to the Middle East around 100,000, 90,000 years ago. Europe, not until 40,000 years ago, which is a very interesting point. The Neanderthals have been living in Europe for 250,000 years before we showed us. And then the contemporary explanation is that we see them going across Eurasia into Asia and then going across. And it's funny because we're looking at a map that shows the world what it looks like today. And that's the big problem, is because that world looked very different even 8,000 years ago. Even 8,000 years ago, what was islands was connected in many places. So we're looking at the spread of when people started going across.
Okay, so humans existing 100,000 years ago, what are the implications of that? I assume, and again, I don't know, but like, is this saying that the idea is that North American humans evolved in a parallel structure, just happened to become human
no,
at the same time?
No, I don't think that's the suggestion at all. I think it may have been, there may have been an earlier migration that may have died out, because genetically speaking, we would probably have seen that evidence.
Yeah.
There would be haploid groups, things like that. There would be some evidence to that, is my estimation of that.
Okay. So, well, so how much credibility do we give this thesis then?
The problem is trying to date things that you find in a pile that you've dated other things is very problematic. It's not like we found tools. We didn't find fossils, human fossils, that we're able to carbon date, which would give us a much better range and expectation. You have different kinds of dating too. That it's one of these things that like young earth creationists and stuff will throw this sort of thing. Well, this kind, the carbon dating is only good for this kind of dating. Like, yeah, well, then we use a different kind of isotopic dating than that one. Some give us broader ranges, some give us narrow ranges. There are hundreds of different ways to date things, you know, within a relatively very predictable way. And when they all tend to match up, you're kind of like, yeah, I think the evidence is pretty strong here. So it's hard. You're just looking at bones. You're just not looking at bones, rather. You're just looking at, you're looking at tools, and tools are made of rock, which dating rock, there are sort of things you can do, but even that's gets to be really hard. So
what phase of this are we at? They've discovered it. They've made their findings known. They've cataloged it. Like where between now and when do we find out, all right, there's some massive holes in this, or maybe we need to take this more seriously?
It becomes one, they started a discussion. They said, hey, we found a thing, and this is from if we found this and it was 8,000 years old, it wouldn't be a debate. You know, it'd be a minor debate. Be like, yeah, no, that makes consistent, whatever, because they're saying it's 100,000 years ago. That's a huge question. So now what you want to do is, one is, not a lot of people look for evidence of humans in North America in strata that's 100,000 years old. The same with Europe, is you don't spend a lot of time looking for strata and things like that where that could be there, because things have changed considerably. Now you're saying, let's look at these things that might have been digging deeper in some locations. You know, what would have been an interesting location in that period? If you think that there was a group of people here in this spot, where else would they have been around there? And you start to extend your search radii. It's a great, you start from that place there and extend the radii outwards, hoping that you might find bones. And then there's also, now we're finding things that like mud in caves, that you can find genetic evidence there because humans, mud came from somewhere. And yeah. So you just extend that outwards and sort of start from here. And then what else?
Dude.
I know. It's fascinating. It's just a fascinating thing that just we're digging our tunnels underground to build our mass transit systems for our robot cars. We may find the humans still living there.
Oh my God, dude, how great would that be? That was one of the things that loved.
Hi.
The descent was about pretty much that, the idea that there was a honeycomb network of this is the book, The Descent, not the movie, the same name.
The book sounds great. Peter J. Wax was telling me all about it too.
Oh no, hold on. We have a gremlin from the underground. What's up, sweetie? What's up?
You want your backpack?
Okay, hold on. A gremlin just asked me to go get her backpack.
No worries. So I'm going to ask Justin a thing here. When I watched this video and I started thinking about the idea of self-driving cars, is what else can be self-driving? Imagine, like, you know, I went through putting a bunch of stuff in storage, and we talked about the storage thing before. You know, the idea of like the storage, the self-driving storage unit that just pulls up to your place.
Yes.
And you load it into and it goes off. But think about this. You got to entertain a bunch of friends. And you're like, you know what? It'd be great to have a bar and a DJ. Let's just have this mobile unit pull up in front of our house that's got the bar and the DJ in there, or the dining chairs, or whatever else we need.
Man, you want to know what? That's actually brilliant, because, you know, there are – have you been to one of these like container park things?
Yeah.
Like just those, like that idea is always just so brilliant that you can sell these, you know, super high value but tiny little, rents that can kind of come and go, and you can, it's optimized for people to build something real quick and then take it right out. And, but that, to extend that to, yeah, like let's just have something kind of like Airstream size that can just sort of like pop out, and here's your party, here's your stage, here's your bar, like boom, and then it can just drive right off.
You could have a kitchen Because I was thinking about the idea of what if the garage became a docking port for these sort of modular sort of things, so that you have your nice tiny little house, but when you want to like, let's you have a gourmet kitchen tonight come up that we can go prepare some fun food with, whatever, that goes there. The idea of the you want to put on a festival, we want to go do weird things a thon, and I'm like, you know what, we just need a plot of land to go do this in, and we can tell people want hotel rooms, they just order hotel rooms, and the hotel rooms are self-driving pods that show up with beds inside and rooms there.
Oh man, dude, that would be amazing. Uber for hotel, and it just like drives you to wherever, you know, place it is, but it's all oh my god, if there was actually just a hotel room that I could like go and sleep in, and maybe like the shower is like in whatever facility that it's in, but then it'll drop you off wherever you needed to go. You just jump out all tuned up. Oh, that'd be great. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, it's been pointed out, like, there are companies that will drive, will deliver stages and tents and stuff. Yes, that's a thing. That's absolutely a thing. It's an expensive thing. And there's the idea here is when everything gets there are companies that have people that will drive you around in a vehicle called limos and taxis. But once you get rid of the people quotient, or you reduce the cost or increase the efficiencies of it, you start thinking about it very, very differently. If you start thinking about here's the problem with like doing a convention. When you want to do a convention in a city, you've got to make sure there's enough places to eat, there's enough hotel rooms. But when you can make all that entirely modular, where you have, we're going to need 500 hotel units to show up at this area, this convention center, whatever. We're going to have 500 hotel units are going to show up there. We're going to need, we're going to probably need 30 automated food trucks or whatever. When all that's on demand and robotic, it makes it possible to throw up, do pop-up festivals, all sorts of stuff in a simple way. For us, it's simple. It's a very, very neat way to think about, I have a small apartment, and then I can have something come in and dock with my apartment, and with that I can have whatever add-ons I need.
You are just totally it blew my mind there. Like, now all I can think of is all the possibilities. Because you're right. You know, there's an occupancy thing. There was a story last week that in Philadelphia, the NFL had their draft, and this also happened when the DNC was there, when I was there covering it for BitTorrent. We had to stay an hour outside of town. When the NFL was there last week, the visiting Miami Marlins, who were playing baseball, had to stay in Delaware because there was just a capacity problem, right?
Yeah.
And if you have even big things like that, you can have everybody stay in Delaware, but for them, they would just be in Philly, right? You just get into this thing. You're in your car. You're in your room. You're taking care of things. It drives you to wherever it stays. And then next thing you know, boom, you get dropped back off the next day.
Yeah. And there have been examples of interesting ways to take advantage of a place. When I lived in Japan, they had the little micro hotels, which I love, but it was never really caught on here, whatever, because people want more space, whatever. And that's a place you get when your density gets so high. But Airbnb, we got that and those things like that instead. But when you start thinking about everything being super, super modular, both how it scales, and I think that's going to be the story of the next decade or so. And when you enter in automation and you're not paying somebody to drive that. And that was another thing, by the way, they showed. Did you see the Tesla, the silhouette of the Tesla semi?
No.
So they're developing their own semi truck, and then Elon gleefully described driving it around and how easily it handles. But that's bigging large scale things, where you can put them and how they're going to move around. I think it's very, very different. You know, we had this, there was sort of the Neal Stephenson snow crashy kind of future where we're living in storage units and stuff like that, which has been iterated multiple times. I think the idea is that we live in, you get a small unit with virtual screens, things like that, whatever. But the reality is that you have this modularity of other things that can come in and play and talk with you. I love the idea of I don't prefer living in one of all those sci-fi universes. Their economics always tend to be very skewed, and I don't think they understand how things would likely to play out. But when you think about the idea of like, I would love to have a Tesla RV.
Sure.
Which would just be like you described, like that. But anyhow, I think it's a very, very fascinating thing to think about. We try to imagine you know, we see a technology and we try to put our contemporary context into it when it actually changes everything rather dramatically. And then, you know, it's, you know, like, what's the internet going to be in the 1990s? I've been watching some old like movies and documentaries in the early 90s about the web. You're like, yeah, it'll make for a, you know, this email thing, it's going to be a threat to mail. I see that. And like, yeah, this, these internet websites, you know, like I could see, you know, catalog printers, you know, are going to have a problem because if I can just go to my catalog and get that, it's like, yeah, it's not just the catalog printer, but it's Sears and everybody else, because then you get a thing like Walmart possible, and then, or Amazon, et cetera. So
it's the fabric of reality that will be totally distorted and turned on its head when you can interconnect everything and not just like, oh, I think my cousin's on one of those. He loves Doctor Who.
Yeah. So, Brian, we just sort of went over the idea of once you start making transportation robotic, you can have anything show up at your door, a hot tub that you just borrow for 6 hours, a kitchen that you can do if you want to throw a party. Have
holy
a
whole, cow. Know, hold on. You just introduced
bars, things like that. Go ahead.
Maybe it hadn't, I've forgotten about it, but the idea of anything other than permanent ownership, the idea of time slice ownership, wow. It may be so much cheaper to rent a hot tub for, you know, I don't know, 3 weeks and then like get rid of it and we'll rent it again whenever we feel like it. That's astonishing.
And it's all on a platform. You think about your house where what your garage becomes, it comes sort of a docking bay for different modules that go in there. Or things can go in front yard. But if you want to have a, you know, if you and Bonnie decide you want to have a party, you call a company and, you know, the rentals show up, all the chairs thing, everything else like there with, you know, the DJ with all that automated whatever shows up in front of your place. It's all there. You want your storage stuff, your storage thing, your auto, this cargo container goes in your garage. You load it up there, close it up. It goes off. You never talk to a human. It's all automated. It goes underground somewhere, wherever. You don't care about it. Like we're paying for cloud storage. It's cloud storage for objects and tools. You want to go work on a project this weekend. Like, you know what? I could really use a good tool shop.
Wow. And all of a sudden you press a button.
You need to write your near future thriller like that. This is such an amazing, awesome world. This is so rad, and it will be our world, but I feel like it's so rad right now.
Yeah.
Well, keep in mind, the workshop idea is not that far off, because we already have pod-based storage, right? Where it's like it's a half a shipping container that just shows up. So imagine like when something strikes you, you spend, I don't know, I would guess what, $300 for a weekend. You press a button, you pay $300, and a portable workshop shows up for 72 hours that you're able to create anything you want. And I assume as part of it, like you can arrange things how you want and then press save basically so that the next time you reorder that, it might not be the same workshop, but that same, but it will, whatever shows up will have everything arranged exactly the way you left it.
Yeah. I mean, here are the two advantages that come through once we start moving these things around automatically. The two big advantages. One is you're not paying for a person to go there. So I used a couple pods containers. Somebody had to put them on a truck.
Yep.
Woman who did it was amazing. By the way, had a lifter, had to put them on a truck, drive the truck to my place. I loaded them up. Then she had to come take those things, put them back on the truck, then take them to warehouse and go do that. You have your capital cost, but after your capital cost, your biggest cost is always going to be the price of human labor. That's problem number one, right? So automation reduces that cost. The second advantage you get is when you talk about like, you know, if I need to borrow tools or I need to do this right now, I can go rent tools from Lowe's or Home Depot, but I need to have a Lowe's or a Home Depot that's 4 or 5 miles away at most for it to be practical. But I still have to go there and do that. But if I have a tool depot or a center where these things are stored that can be 15 miles away. One of the examples of this is like you watch movies like LA movies or Hollywood stuff and you see the star trailers, like, you know, the stars going to their trailers. Yeah. Well, there was Wagoner, like star wagons, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that was invented by, I think, Robert Wagner, let me get his name, because he came up with the idea, or he was the guy that started the character, or started the business.
But basically, he recognized that this is a universal demand, and that you could, you know, formalize what
yeah, it was
because,
you know, like people wanted to have their own little trailers, had this thing, but it wasn't a practical thing because of the fact that studios have limited their space constrained. And if you don't want to have a bunch of these trailers filling up all the space that you're trying to use. And so, Lyle Waggoner. OK, so Star Wagons, that's where it came from. So what happened was he said, you know what? If we have if another company owns the trailers and you just order your trailers, say we need 10 trailers for tomorrow, we ship them from some middle of nowhere place where it's cheap to store them, drive them to the set, park them there, leave them there for however long you need. And then when it's time, we come grab the trailers and bring them back. The studio doesn't have to expense the cost of trying to store them, doesn't have to pay for them, whatever. It becomes a rentable thing. And that was a really cool innovation. And you can extrapolate that into automation and stuff and other things. And I think it's a very fascinating sort of future.
Yeah, man. I'll tell you what. Basically, what you're talking about is like Uber for things, right? Where it's I want a wonderful fire pit. I don't want to have to maintain a wonderful fire pit. I don't want to have to set one up. I don't want to have to build one. I don't want to have the real estate taken up. But tonight I want a fire pit, and I'll pay you $40. You click a button, and then suddenly some drones show up, and sure enough, you have a beautiful chimney there.
Yeah, and it could be a container that all of a sudden opens up into, you know, a larger platform. And that's the thing we could start imagining is like these modular things, something that pulls up in your yard, it unfolds, it's got, you know, the deck unfolds, all this is there, the chairs, there's everything there. I mean, it's a crazy thing to think about. Like, well,
the exciting thing about this thought experiment is that it requires no new innovations. Like everything we've talked about can happen today. It would just be expensive. But once, I mean, in a world where Uber took something that was an existing technology, i.e. taxi cabs, and suddenly figured out a way to cut out like 70% of the wasted margin in there, why not? Why not just like, you know, like there's no experience in the entire life of buying a hot tub better than that first night when you hop in the hot tub and look out at your world anew. And if you could just buy that, it's like buying the last scoop of ice cream or buying the experience instead of the thing that brings the experience.
Well, think about, you know, the joke, like what are the two happiest days in a boat owner's life?
The day he buys it, the day he sells it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And somebody brought up the subject of tiny homes. There's a lot of other kind of modular homes and stuff. You can start thinking about automation and transportation and fast transportation, like allows us to start building our suburbs 100 miles out. If you're going extremely fast underground, whatever, you can build your suburbs much further out than you have before. And then if you have all these conveniences you need, and you can have, you know, you've gone to like food truck festivals, right? You can totally artificial food truck festivals or pop-up shopping malls. And it's just a totally, when we start, we know the next big wave, or we feel the next big wave is treating atoms like we treat bits.
Yeah.
And routing them and moving them through. And we're seeing that incrementally right now. And that's going to progress into just a crazy, amazing future. Somebody says, do you really want to use a hot tub that some strangers have been in? Never been to a hotel?
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah. No. Only way more sanitary because they won't carry the water from the previous owners to you. They'll fill it with new fresh water.
For an extra service fee.
Sure.
It'd be the Lyft versus Uber version. Uber dirty. gentlemen. I guess that's it. I think that's about wrapped up.
Hold on. Yeah. I seem to remember last week we left on a bit of a cliffhanger because in our fantasy journey of Journey Quest, nothing happened.
So we do a thing called Journey Quest where Brian and Justin are on a journey. It's a very clear linear plotline story. We actually had a recap sent to us. I don't know if Bryce has that queued up or not, but there is a
Previously
recap.
On
Journey Quest!
Stan!
Oh, all of a sudden the axe comes down on you.
Oh!
Is this a late season Sopranos episode?
Hey, man. Was that a dream when we died? Hold on. I look at the hemline of the skirt as a clue as to what decade we may or may not be in.
Sure, that's why you do it.
as always, the recap very effectively places us in our current dilemma, which, of course, is in the middle of what appears to be a time travel paradox. We have shown up in a bunker, and as we look forward, we see a beautiful blonde-haired woman and a mustachioed man.
Beautiful, but, you know.
Hey, man.
Although I do hope that as whoever's doing these, number one, thank you for putting the time and effort into doing them. Number two, I hope that this winds up getting to the point that, like many shows that take complicated plot turns, where there's always just going to be one clip that's in the front of all of them that just explains one particularly tricky, like, we're here on Mars. Like, you ever binge watch a show? There's always like the one clip up front that's just like, Joe's dead for 8 episodes, just so everybody always remembers that Joe's dead.
Yeah.
So you guys were, you hop back, you were had your heads cut off, whatever, as far as you thought. Time machine jerks you forward. And next thing you know, you're back inside of the time machine oven situation. You burst out of it and you realize you're not where you started from. You're in a totally different location. You run up the stairs. There was a man sitting at a desk who told you to wait a moment. You see a woman. She nods you. They treated this as the most natural thing in the world that you showed up there. And the woman and him turn around to greet you as you're sitting there eating strudel. And we flash the picture of who it was before that you saw, the smiling, charming couple that provided you some nice pastries and desserts.
They look sweet. They look like our sweet neighbors. Also, one's Hitler and the other is the Hitler banged.
Mava, whatever, Braun.
Braun.
Yeah. He's Hitler in his zoot suit.
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, one moment. Can I talk to Justin for just a moment?
Yeah, sure. Go talk.
All right, Justin.
Ava, we have going to have business in a moment. Please carry on and go in the other room. Okay, I'm going to sit down at my desk again. Good.
All right, Justin. Number one, like between you, me, and the wall, how much do I have to pay you to just shave down that mustache just a little bit on each side? Because I'm thinking you could replace this dude and maybe change the legacy of Hitler forever.
So what's the world last time?
Because I'm looking at you. You got the tie.
Pause. Yes, I'm dressed like Hitler. And yes, if I shave my mustache, I would look more like Hitler.
Yeah, okay? Like real close.
This is known. We know this is a fact, okay? That being said, I think we already tried the let's replace a leader gambit thing once.
Okay, all right.
That didn't all right. go as
all right.
well.
He's like, all right, gentlemen, he speaks to you very loudly. All right, I am not to be disturbed. I am going to be speaking to my friends for the next hour. All right.
Great. Okay. So, all right. Look, he's coming back. I'm sorry. Okay. So obviously. Okay. So what do we do? We do a chokehold. Do we grab him by his one ball or
walking over now? He's coming over to sit down.
Before we immediately take action that involves death, Brian, can we at least get our bearings on where we are and what the situation is?
You're right. Let's give him a chance. I stand up and I'm like, hello, mein Führer. I understand that you probably have brought us here for a reason. We're very honored. And while I personally wanted to kill you on sight, my colleague Justin insisted that we hear you out. He said, if I recall correctly, he said he's probably got some good ideas. So let's hear it, Hitler.
All right. So Hitler just sort of chills back, relaxes a bit. Takes off his shoes, pulls off his socks. He's like, my feet, they hurt so much. He's speaking kind of loud, right? And then he puts a finger to his lips, reaches over to the side of his big stuffed chair, opens up a little box, pulls out a lighter, pulls out a joint, lights it, takes a big, deep breath.
I casually hold my hand out in like a peace-like symbol.
He hands you this, right?
I hand it immediately to Justin.
All right. He looks over at his shoulder and he goes, all right. Been waiting for you guys to show on up.
I got to admit, Mr. Hitler, you seem a lot more relaxed than history had led us to believe.
It is new accent.
Yeah, man. this Hitler thing. Oh boy, I had no idea what I was in for. Well, wait for more travelers like you.
Wait a minute. All right. So,
can we just establish kind of a Texas some facts. Accent, by the way. What's that?
Number one, you are indeed the Hitler. Number two.
No. All right. No, I mean,
let me ask you questions. So, history believes, the world believes that you are the Hitler, and yet you are not. You are a fellow time traveler that has taken the role of Adolf Hitler.
That's right, man. I came back in time. I come from a future where the world was very, very different than what it was, and I wanted to stop a horrific event from happening. See, I'm from Texas, and I had two choices in life. I could either become a physicist or an actor, but I thought nobody ever be able to pronounce Matthew McConaughey.
No way! So
I got into no physics. Way!
Oh my God, this is your greatest role ever!
So point is I decided to try to change history, change it for the better, and try to do what I could. So I came back in time, and I did it. Came this gentleman right before you right now.
Well, number one, Justin, if I may, first of all, Mr. McConaughey, number one, I don't know if you remember, you met my wife once. She was a framer at a framing shop.
Hitler.
Okay, great. Number two, I feel like you were unfairly maligned.
Your wife takes a big, long smoke. Go on.
All right. Number three, Mr. McConaughey, what have you managed to change and what's the same?
Well, it's in progress. You know, things take time, but I'll have you know that Boris is dead. First thing I did when I came back in time is I killed Boris. And you know how everybody says, you know, if you could kill Boris, would you do it? Well, I killed Boris.
Who's Boris?
Exactly.
We're in a post-McConaughey world.
Yeah, you're saying that everything we know is because
better than Boris.
There was a badder person than Hitler, and it was Boris.
Wait, hold on. Wait a minute. So, wait. Matthew McConaughey, number one, before or after Lincoln Lawyer?
You can call me McConaughey Hitler. It's fine.
Okay, Lincoln Lawyer. Did you start time traveling before or after you did the film Lincoln Lawyer?
Oh, no. Whoa, I'm an actor. Where are you from?
Oh, awesome. Okay.
I'm the celebrated physicist from my future.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Matthew McConaughey. I never knew you had this
Matthew
in you.
Matthew McConaughey is in a world where...
Yeah, my coworker Dolph Lundgren, he and I, you know, put together our Advanced Particle Physics Institute and decided if we could do one thing, it would be better off to save humanity to help prevent the biggest tragedy of the 20th century, and that would be to kill Boris, and that's what we did.
All right, and forgive me, my memories are a little bit hazy.
Listen,
remind me, what was it Boris did?
Boris was the worst. Boris was like the worst you could imagine. Sorry, Hitler Jr. Go ahead.
Hitler, McConaughey Hitler. I'm just going to set the line at 6 million. We going over or under on Boris? How many?
16 million what?
No, 6 million. How many people did Boris kill that you had to come back and stop? I'm setting the line at 6 million. Did he go over or under?
Oh, well, you know, there's a lot between the wars he started and the genocide and that sort of thing. I think it was like 5,999,099.
Ah, bad news. Yeah. Bad news, Mr. McConaughey Hitler. Mr. McConaughey Hitler.
What?
Well, you might be in our timeline, the timeline that you're in right now, the reality that you've entered. I don't know how far along we are, but we know
that... So, point it was, Boris, what we did was, I was like an ambulance driver. Well, Hitler was in World War I, and we knew Boris was a Russian soldier walking along, and we knew what road he was, so I just took that little ambulance, and then I did a little bit of swerve, and the next thing you know, no more Boris. Future saved. Thank you.
Hold on. So, you're saying you killed... Or, Boris... Oh, geez.
6 million people
the question,
are dead.
I mean, of course, a regular question
that makes 6 million...
If you 6 million. If you could kill baby Boris, would you? And he obviously waited a little bit longer than a baby, but
okay, listen. There's just so you know, we appear to be from different timelines. There are some people who have asked us if there's a way to have stopped you from not appearing in season two of True Detective, and if killing you would somehow prevent that future from happening.
Now, I recognize the words you're saying, but I don't think I understand what you're saying.
Matthew McConaughey, Hitler, what year is it right now?
1943.
That's like a while before the nuke dropped, right?
I'm not up on my World War. Are we currently in a world war, Matthew McConaughey?
Yeah,
it's a little messy right now. You know, part of what is the machinations of stuff and the tech. Well, it works when you go back into somebody. Sometimes they do the things they're going to do kind of thing. And, you know, this guy, this Hitler fellow, well, let me tell you what, man.
Real quick, Mr. Professor McConaughey, how did you get here? Did you develop your own time travel technology? Do you have the ability to go back to your own timeline?
Well, it was more of a drug because, you know, Dolph is a chemical engineer.
And are you just going to live out the rest of your life here, or are you planning?
I'm just gonna make sure things work right, and this is the way I stay here. And he takes another puff.
Okay, real quick. If you could outline for us like the three core tenets of your dictatorship.
Guys, I'm not here to talk politics. Not here to talk politics. I'm just here to tell you, you know, enjoy the eagle's nest, enjoy the strudel. Problem is solved. Problem is solved. It's no Boris.
Okay, so I got a real good news, bad news here for you, Matthew McConaughey, Hitler. Number one, bad news. If you had lived your life as an actor, you could have done way better than Eva. I mean, she's like a two compared to where you're playing
Hold on. Pause just a moment. Excuse me, Matthew. Let me take a gander at your missus. Let's take a little look-see here. Ooh, you got to agree with Justin. I mean, don't get me wrong. If you were a insurance salesman in Minnesota, I think you would have done real nice. But you're not. You're a dictator of the most powerful European country.
Hey, by the way, though, good news, we've never even heard of Boris. Boris never exists in our timeline. You have successfully eliminated somebody that killed
5,999,999 people. Yeah,
plus Boris.
Are you ready for some more bad news?
Yeah, real quick, let me just check in. How do you feel about homosexuals?
In what context?
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure right now you're rounding them up and throwing them into death camps.
I don't get into the minutiae of what people do around here. You know, politics is not my thing. You know, it's the 1940s.
What about Jewish people? How do you feel?
Oh, they're great. Love them.
Why make them wear the thing and go to the places?
Have you gotten
that? Wasn't exactly my idea, but the way that was explained to me was that they have been the victims of prejudice, and we need to be able to protect them. And in order to protect them, you got to see who you're supposed to protect.
Oh my goodness! Just one moment, my Fuhrer, Justin.
Yeah.
I don't think he knows what's going on.
Yeah, you think he gets high on space weed all day so he can stay in this current
okay,
form.
But
there's a knock on the door.
It's real.
And a sharp Nazi uniform mops in. Fuhrer, I have some more papers for you to sign. Some more of our healthiness and our cleanliness, sort of our hygiene project. Guys, hold on a second.
No.
Gustav,
you're
not going to tell them about this, right? Don't tell them about this. Guys, I'm just going to sign this thing right now.
Real quick. As your most trusted advisors, which I can only
that's the problem.
I would assume we are, since you went all the trouble through teleporting us through time and space, allow the guy who looks like almost identically to you with a slightly larger mustache to explain why this might not be a good idea.
Almost identical. Okay. Here's the deal. There's one thing you from Texas really appreciate.
I'm like, shh, point to the Nazi.
From Austria.
Yeah.
Texas, Austria. The neighborhood that we all came from. Texas, Austria.
Texas, Austria.
Old world thing. You wouldn't understand. Here's what you appreciate is a more streamlined government. So I got a few budget cuts. I've looked over the books. Here are some things that we can defund immediately. I'm just going to name a couple things. We can just start cutting funding to those. No more. In fact, everybody who's there, send them on home. No need to be out there. Totally useless. Just Auschwitz, Birkenau, Dachau.
Our slogan as a shared populace is keep Austria weird, right? So let's do that.
So that's what I think we should be doing immediately is just cut line item cuts. No new camps. Too much money.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to look into these things. Again, no. I don't get in the minutiae. Be honest, ever since I killed Boris, I've just been sort of either drunk or high most of the time, celebrating the fact that I saved the world.
Okay, well, first of all, in our timeline, it's
that party gone on? Like, we have literally been doing this for, like, up to,
you know, a lot of parts of my rise to power was I legalized weed in Germany.
Okay, but
something that the history books don't remember.
What they do remember, the history books do remember, you did a lot of meth. You kind of are known as the meth dictator. Is that how you want to go down?
I invented some new technologies, some new stuff. So anyhow, boys, I'm saying it's nice of you to visit, but you can go on home. It's all taken care of here.
All right. Can I have a moment to sidebar with my colleague, Justin?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm going to go in my grow room. Go check on it.
All right.
We have to kill Matthew McConaughey, right?
Wait, how does that do anything?
Well, I mean, like, you just shave off...
Cut out. He's totally cut out from the situation. It's people below him that are making these decisions.
He's not interested in fixing anything. I'm just saying if we killed him and you shaved the sides of your mustache.
No, I am not assuming the role of Hitler.
No.
Okay. Absolutely not. 100% no.
Okay, but you could save, like, I don't know, a dozen lives. It sounds like he's already on track to kill as many as Boris did. I mean, it's like, what's the point? At least we'll have the chance to steer the fatherland into its proper place in history.
Okay, well, number one, the fatherland is very troubling nomenclature when we're talking about non-Nazi things. Number two, no, we are not killing that. We can't solve every problem with killing the sovereign. We keep running into these sovereigns. We need to figure out a way that doesn't involve killing people.
Okay,
shaving down
hold
my
on,
muscle.
Hold on, wait, stop, I got a phone stop. Call. Uh-huh. Oh, he's here. He's here. All right. Send him right in. Hey, Winston Churchill's coming in here.
Wait, you're friends with Winston Churchill?
But you'll never guess who he actually is. Next time on Journey Quest.
Oh, shit. Pretty good.
Renegue, all right.
So, next time on Journey Quest, we're going to find out how different is this world that Matthew McConaughey shaped for us by going back in time and killing our number one enemy of the 20th century, Boris.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. That's great. That's good.
So, gentlemen, do we have any picks?
Yeah, man. I'm going to pick Stars, American Gods, which if you have Stars, you're able to preview it before its official premiere. It's based on the Neil Gaiman work. It's got Ian McShane from Deadwood fame as the fantastic Mr. Wednesday. There are a number of things that are slightly different from the book, but I'll be damned if it wasn't hypnotic and strange and wonderful. And keep in mind, this is coming from somebody who read the book. There's giant chunks that I don't understand what is happening, and I'm really excited for that to be the case.
You listen to the book, Brian. You listen to the book.
Don't be that guy. Don't be that guy.
I love being that guy to you. I love being that guy.
I have fully experienced the book to the author's deepest intent. How about that?
I am going to pick Veep on HBO. I thought last season was a little uneven. This season, I have not watched the episode last night, but the first episode was amazing. Back to top form. It finds our main character, Selina Meyer, who previously was vice president and president, now out of the White House and dealing with what it's like to be an ex-president. It's awesome. It puts all the characters at their best, which is at their breaking point of humiliation. It's amazing.
My pick is it's on Netflix now. I've watched this before. It's an extremely well-done movie. It is a very nuanced movie that I beg anybody who saw it the first time and may have been left a little bit with it, go watch it again and maybe go a few months later, watch it again just to pick up on all the little details, because it is very much a movie that is in layers, and you have to watch it. You have to watch it again to appreciate the layers. And each time you watch it, you pick up more on it. And that is The Prestige.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I loved it enough in the theater that I watched it twice in the theater, and then seeing it a second time, like 2 or 3 years later, there are a number of small details that you pick up that it's so well crafted.
So The Prestige is the story about two rival magicians played by Batman and Wolverine, while Black Widow is also has an assist there, and Alfred is present too. So
it's a curious piece of fan fiction, The Prestige.
Yeah.
Yeah. They are aided by the Goblin King.
Yes. And King Kong. And you look through that list of like, oh my God, you know, who is and Gollum. Yeah. And
Piper Perabo.
Yeah. So, but it's a great cast, amazing, typical. I mean, really good Christopher Nolan. Things are told out of sequence, and you sort of put it together, and then the tale of the rival magicians, and then you get to the end. The first time through, there's two twists there that are kind of like the rechange the context. But then, but when you watch it knowing those twists, and you watch it again, you don't lose anything by that payoff. It actually enhances it, because then you're aware of, oh, what I thought were two storylines are actually, you know, the second time through, you think about it like, oh, I'm watching three storylines. And then you watch it again and you kind of think about the fact that like, oh my God, I'm watching like a bunch of storylines.
Yeah.
You know, and just an incredibly complex. And that's a movie you could do a whole podcast on it, just talking about just what made that so special. And there's little things in there too, little nuances. Now, the book that it was based on was The Prestige. I think it was Christopher Priest wrote that book. And yeah. I thoroughly enjoyed the book. But the book is very different. The book is told from contemporary times. And this woman who's the daughter of who, you know, we'll say was the great, 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 you know, and a descendant of the Lord of the Anton character. And the Danton character, and finding these journals and this sort of stuff, and then finding, you know, hidden in this mausoleum are the prestige materials, and uncovering what's going on and what that is. And so you could read the novel as almost a sequel to it. So if you wanted to have a kind of interesting audiobook, it's kind of a weird sort of thing. You watch The Prestige, then you read the book, and you kind of know what's going on, but it's a very cool unfolding of that. Very well done. Very well done. So it's my pick.
Very cool. Yeah.
And a lot of the themes in the book, like the book has much more of this kind of horror kind of tone to it in a way that the movie is focuses on other elements. They're both exceptional. Everybody should watch and read them immediately.
Yeah, the book is a very different experience. It tells the story from a different point of view. So it's kind of cool. Gentlemen. All right, all right, all right. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.